The fiscal side is the most significant issue we'll deal with this session, I believe.
Governor Walker talks about his priorities for the upcoming legislative session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, social conservatives recognize they will have a hard time keeping their issues on the legislative agenda.
It's just one more session and with one more reason to put our issues on the back burner.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you are a rural Alaskan knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in your region, please consider applying for one of the 35 seats on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Council meetings serve as a forum for regional public involvement in federal subsistence management. Apply by January 23, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Alaska Legislature gavels in tomorrow afternoon for the 29th session. Lawmakers, along with all Alaskans, will get a better sense of Governor Bill Walker's agenda for the next 90 days in two speeches this week, the State of the State and the State of the Budget. Walker took some time today to talk about his priorities. He says he has a few guiding principles as he crafts a budget this year.
Don't panic. Don't overreact. Have a plan. We're going to have a plan that's going to show us going out either 3 or 5 years as far as what the glide slope of the reduction is going to be. And we're looking at, you know, what can be done within administration as far as combinations, efficiencies, collaboration between departments, ways that we can, look internally first. We don't know how long we're going to be in this situation, so we're going to assume we're going to be in it for 2 to 3 years. So our plan will go out that far and perhaps as far as 5 years.
Should other revenue sources, an income tax, a sales tax, or perhaps taxes on fishing and mining, should those be on the table?
I think it's too soon to have that discussion. I think we need to get our house adjusted a bit on the spending side before we look there, because otherwise those are going to provide the new revenues are going to say, well, wait a minute, what have you done to sort of get your house in order? So I think we owe it to the general public and to the business public to make those adjustments first.
Governor, development of a pipeline to get North Slope natural gas to market has long been a priority of Alaska lawmakers. It's long been a priority of yours. Earlier this month, you said there would be a paradigm shift in how Alaska manages its oil and gas, and that dealing with the industry will likely be different. How does your method for advancing a natural gas project differ from your predecessor?
I think I believe that Alaska needs to be more at the table, more involved than we have been in the past. And I think that more engaged with the market. I've been very, very concerned that in the past we've let somebody else address issues associated with the market, and yet we are in some circumstances 1/8 owner, in some cases a 25% owner of the resource. We need to be very engaged with the market on this. It's a critical piece of the puzzle is make sure we have the market participation early on.
What issues would you like to see the legislature tackle during this session?
Well, I think we clearly have to tackle the fiscal situation, and that's really sort of the overriding issue by far, as far as on the fiscal situation. I'm certainly hopeful on the Medicaid expansion that's something that we can work collaboratively on. But really, it's the fiscal side is the most significant issue we'll deal with this session, I believe.
Previously, key members of the legislature have expressed reluctance to move forward with expansion of Medicaid. Do you see this as being an obstacle?
I think it'll be something we have a discussion about. I'm not sure it's an obstacle, but I think we're going to be able to show that actually by accepting Medicaid, it'll be there'll be a reduction in cost as a result of that to the state, a net reduction. So we'll see. We'll have a discussion about that, and I'll look forward to that.
I don't believe you've used the word crisis to describe the state's multi-billion dollar shortfall. At least I don't think I've heard that. Why is that?
I think partly because I've been through some crises in Alaska. When we had an earthquake in 64, that was a crisis. We have a savings account that I'm not saying we're going to live off of that, but we have resources. We can manage our way out of this, and so I don't want us to overreact to the situation. It's serious. We need to address it, but we can manage ourselves out of the situation that we're in. So I may have said the word crisis a time or two. I'm not sure, but as the more I work at it, the more I look at it, the more I realize that it's a matter of working to manage our way out of this rather than necessarily overreact.
That was Alaska Governor Bill Walker. Lawmakers have a lot to accomplish this session. There's the multi-billion dollar deficit the state faces. There's also work to be done on Alaska's marijuana laws after voters decided to legalize and regulate the drug in November. The full agenda means other controversial subjects, like abortion, may take a back seat. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
When Republicans took control of both chambers of the legislature 2 years ago, social conservatives viewed it as a win. Legislation restricting Medicaid payments for abortion, a longstanding priority for them, finally got hearings and was even signed into law before being enjoined by the courts. But even though the composition of the legislature is mostly the same, advocates for anti-abortion measures like waiting periods and clinic regulations aren't expecting to get as much traction due to the attention on the state's budget. Jim Minnery is the president of Alaska Family Action.
It's just one more session and with one more reason to put our issues on the back burner. We're sort of the ugly stepchild in the room when it comes to issues down in Juneau. I mean, even our allies sometimes have a hard time, charging the hill.
Beyond a climate where lawmakers are more focused on fiscal issues, leadership of some key committees has changed in a way that is less friendly to abortion legislation. One of the Senate's more moderate Republicans, Liesl McGuire, has taken over the Judiciary Committee. She takes the reins from Senator John Coghill, a socially conservative Republican from North Pole who sponsored the Medicaid abortion bill and shepherded it through the Senate. With the health committees, both the House chair, Homer Republican Paul Seaton, and the Senate chair, Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, have voted against legislation restricting abortion access. Minnery sees that as an obstacle to abortion legislation moving forward.
Certainly, I can't say that we were pleased with the Seaton and Stedman being given those chairs, because they've shown a repeated resistance to advancing of our legislation. But, there are two players in a lot of folks down there.
Jennifer Allen is a policy director with Planned Parenthood Votes Northwest, and she says her group is looking at the committee chairs, but from the opposite policy perspective.
We will simply keep talking to them about why they should be setting aside any anti-abortion bills and addressing the real issues that affect Alaska women's health.
House Health Chair Paul Seaton says he would like to hold hearings on all bills assigned to his committee, no matter what the subject matter. But he says that the legislature's biggest fight over abortion, how the term medically necessary should be defined for the purposes of Medicaid reimbursement, has already been played out.
On that issue particularly, there's already been a bill on that, and there's already been regulations which are being challenged in court. So I think that that's already probably progressed as far as that's going to be.
Former Judiciary Chair John Coghill is working on bills to regulate abortion, but he says that dealing with the state's fiscal problems will come first. Senate President Kevin Meyer agrees.
Well, they won't be a priority, but that's not to say that they won't get through the process and get on the floor and still get passed this year.
If an abortion restriction bill makes it through the legislature, it may put Governor Bill Walker in a difficult situation. Walker personally opposes abortion and sought support from Alaska Family Action earlier in his political career when he was registered as a Republican. when he renounced his party affiliation and merged his ticket with Democrat Byron Mallott, Walker said he would not advance an anti-abortion agenda and, at one point, stated he would veto anti-abortion bills before later rescinding that statement. Minery says Alaska Family Action hopes to rekindle its relationship with Walker. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lonnie Dupree talks about how close he was to running out of food and fuel on his successful Denali climb.
I was a scrawny, cranky, kind of scared individual.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
A fight over the Keystone XL pipeline is likely to heat up in Congress this week. Senate Bill 1 would permit the pipeline to cross the Canadian border into Montana, moving Alberta tar sands oil. Senator Lisa Murkowski, as the new chairman of the Energy Committee, is leading the Republican charge. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, some Alaskans say she's pulling for the wrong project.
Mike Wenstrup, chairman of the Alaska Democratic Party, says Murkowski should be working to advance Alaska's energy projects, not Canada's. In an op-ed published in the Alaska Dispatch News this weekend, he alleges she's following orders from pro-Keystone lobbyists. For Wenstrup, it's a direct line between the dots.
Alberta sands, tar sands, compete with Alaska oil field for capital. Promoting Keystone will help our competitors in Canada at the expense of our oil fields.
Murkowski, on the Senate floor last week, said she's been hearing from constituents who wonder if Keystone would be bad for Alaska.
And I've been asked, well, we understand that Keystone is in the national interest. We get that. But is it really in Alaska's best interest? And folks back home are a little worried right now.
Murkowski says Keystone helps Alaska. For one thing, she says, the pipeline is expected to pick up some Bakken shale oil from Montana and North Dakota as it heads down to refineries on the Gulf Coast. Without the pipeline, Murkowski says, some of that oil moves by rail to West Coast refineries, which is where Alaska's oil goes.
This ANS crude, Alaska North Slope crude as we call it, is now finding itself in competition from the shale plays out of the Bakken.
Keystone will redirect the oil south, leaving more refinery space for Alaska crude, Murkowski says. We put the question to two oil economists. Both said Keystone would do no harm to Alaska oil prices or investment in Alaska fields. Kenneth Medlock is the senior director at the Center for Energy Studies at Rice University.
In reality, the amount of crude oil you're talking about moving out of the Keystone XL pipeline down to the Gulf Coast is not enough to really do significant harm to the economic viability of ANS.
Medlock says the Keystone output and Alaska oil differ in weight and composition, and in an efficient system, wouldn't likely go to the same refineries. Medlock says oil from Keystone will displace oil at Gulf Coast refineries, but it will be heavy barrels from Venezuela and Mexico that are displaced, not those from the North Slope. He says the same of investment dollars. If Keystone makes Alberta projects more attractive, it's at the expense of Venezuela and Mexico, he says.
When you take a step back and look at it from a broader sort of global perspective and understand the efficient flow of crude oil and understand the differences in the grades of crude oil, I think it actually makes a lot of sense for Alaska to support Keystone, believe it or not.
As Medlock sees it, when everybody's oil moves efficiently to the most appropriate refinery, everyone benefits. Ed Herz, who teaches energy economics at University of Houston, also says Keystone XL isn't a threat to Alaska's development, citing similar reasons. Heavy Canadian crude is already flowing down pipelines to Gulf Coast refineries, Herz says, and just last week that capacity shot up when a new line opened.
Keystone is just one more avenue for doing that. This is not going to depress the price.
The existing low prices do inhibit investment, but Herz says the harm is much greater in North Dakota and Alberta than in Alaska, where production is relatively cheap.
We're seeing hundreds of rigs being laid down in the shale plays right now across the United States, and this portends well for Alaskan development because of the size of the conventional reservoirs in Alaska that can be accessed.
Murkowski says Alaskans should also want to see Keystone built as a test.
It's a test of whether or not we as a nation can still review, can license, can permit, and build a large-scale energy infrastructure project.
If we can't build this one, she says, what hope do we have for Alaska's next big project? In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Environmental Protection Agency released a proposal last week to review the use of chemical dispersants in oil spill response. An environmental group based in Homer was part of the first push to change the existing dispersant rules. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
In some ways, this review began as a result of BP's 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Bob Shavelson is the director of Cook Inlet Keeper, a member organization of the Earth Justice Coalition.
British Petroleum sprayed, you know, almost 2 million gallons of dispersants into the Gulf of Mexico, and we recognize we really don't understand the toxicity of this product. We don't know what's in it. And so we got together with other groups across the nation, and we petitioned EPA to finally release this rule.
Maddie Stanislaus is the assistant administrator for EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response.
I am responsible for, among other things, overseeing the emergency planning and response a program for EPA.
He says there is already a rule in place, but the BP spill caused a wave of community concern and feedback that EPA is now addressing. The proposed changes would take a more in-depth look at dispersants and their short and long-term impacts in different environments.
Looking at different kind of conditions, how does these agents react to cold conditions versus warmer conditions? How should we look at different kind of species? So it's a far broader set of considerations than currently in the rule and what we incorporated during Deepwater Horizon.
The revisions would also take a more aggressive approach to monitoring dispersants. Stanislaus said there would be parameters in place to decide whether or not to use them. Then he says the rule would push for minimizing use to decrease impacts to shoreline and wildlife.
So we monitor those impacts, and if it would have exceeded levels that we have established, then we would stop using dispersants. So we bring those kind of monitoring requirements as part of the basic structure of the rule.
The revisions include more research on the toxicity of dispersants and other chemical and biological agents. There would also be new criteria for listing products as appropriate for oil spill response based on effectiveness and toxicity. EPA states that dispersant manufacturers will use a peer-reviewed laboratory method for testing their products.
To make sure that it is a rigorous scientific analysis of the agents for EPA able to evaluate and list it pursuant to this rule.
But wildlife and environment aren't the only concerns addressed in the proposal. There would be additional human health and safety information requirements as well, which Bob Shavelson says is very important.
There were an untold number of illnesses in the Gulf from the BP oil spill and from the use of dispersants, and we don't have a good handle on that. So we really want to understand what that means if we're going to use dispersants in and around Alaska communities.
He says he'd like to see some of the studies move outside inside the lab to get the most accurate and diverse set of data possible, especially in extremely biodiverse cold water environments like Alaskan waters. He says it's hard to be sure exactly what will happen.
I think, we need to talk to our scientists and get a better understanding on where you could have a controlled experiment where you're not going to have undue impacts, but you're going to understand how dispersants behave.
EPA is accepting public comments on the proposal 90 days following publication in the Federal Register. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Climber Lonnie Dupree has returned to Talkeetna after becoming the first soloist to ever summit Denali in the month of January. While in town, he stopped in to talk with KTNA's Philip Manning.
Lonnie Dupree's historic climb began on December 18th, and he summited Denali on January 11th, just after 2 p.m. Like most climbs on North America's tallest peak, the weather factored into Lonnie Dupree's expedition. He says one big difference between this year and his prior attempts is the amount of snow.
The hardest thing, hands down, on this trip for me was the deep snow. We had very deep snow right out of base camp and all the way up to the top of the mountain almost. And then dragging, in the beginning, 194-pound sled through that deep snow, it doesn't slide, it just plows.
Dupree was helped through the snow by his homemade skis, which are 8 feet long and 4 inches wide. He says the snow was due to warm weather and low pressure in the Alaska Range. Lonnie Dupree says that warmer weather can actually be a problem.
I would much, much, much prefer 30, 40 below zero day in and day out because you're drier, you actually can operate better. And usually when it's that cold, you don't have the winds with that.
One time that the winds did play a major role in the climb was when Lonnie Dupree was between 10,000 and 11,000 feet of elevation. He says the wind picked up and started blowing lots of snow. He stashed much of his gear and went ahead to establish his camp. Then the weather really moved in and caught Dupree with meager supplies.
Just a day and a half's worth of food and 22 ounces of fuel, which is about 3 days' worth of fuel. But I just stretched both the food and the fuel for 5.5 days. And so I was a scrawny, cranky, kind of scared individual.
Lonnie Dupree says he was scared because he knew there was no way for help to arrive if conditions didn't improve. He says one or two more days might have seen him succumb to lack of food or warmth. Eventually, Mother Nature relented and Dupree was on his way again. As he reached the higher section of Denali, Lonnie Dupree says the forecast called for a window of 2 days with weather good enough to perhaps try to reach the summit. In the dark hours of the morning on January 11th, he made his run. Right around 2 p.m., Dupree saw what he had spent 4 years trying to reach, the official marker for the highest point in North America.
And I seen that, and I just kind of broke down a little bit because it's been four years of hard work. And then I spent 10 minutes, no longer, on the top. I gave a good look around twice, and then I started hightailing it out of there.
The wind was picking up yet again, but Lonnie Dupree was able to get back to his camp and his gear before it got too rough. Then it was a race against weather moving in from the south. Dupree made it back to base camp at 7,200 feet on December 14th, but high winds prevented his pickup by airplane. The next day, though, Talkeetna Air Taxi pilot Paul Roderick says the weather, which was not forecast to be favorable, opened up.
I thought we might have a little window to work with because you could see there was a seam in the system, but not this good. It was actually generally improving. It was still windy, but actually on the southeast fork of the Kilna Glacier was calm and 20 degrees. And so it was just perfect conditions. It was actually couldn't have been better.
After cold, snow, storms, and wind, Lonnie Dupree had achieved his goal and returned safely to the lowlands. He was greeted by sponsors, friends, and members of the Talkeetna climbing community. With a successful trip behind him, Lonnie Dupree says he will likely come back to Talkeetna, but probably for slightly less strenuous activities than climbing to the top of the continent by himself during the coldest, darkest period of the year. For now, he's just happy to be back. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Bethel's Pete Kaiser is king of the Kuskokwim. Kaiser and his team crossed the finish line of the Kuskokwim 300 in Bethel at 5:31 Sunday morning with a team of 9 dogs in the 36th running of the race. Kaiser is the first local musher in 29 years to win the Kusko 300. KYUK's Ben Matheson has the story.
Roan Boozer's 7-minute edge on Kaiser as they left the final 4-hour layover at Tulixac wasn't enough. Kaiser passed Boozer on the way to Bethel and met a welcoming crowd.
Pete, Pete Kaiser! It's all about that Pete! That Pete, Pete Kaiser!
Kind of crazy. Just kind of like a dream come true, but don't really know what to say.
When he arrived, a fan handed him a bottle of champagne that the normally reserved musher shook and showered on himself and the crowd. Kaiser began mushing as a kid in Bethel. He grew up watching the Kuskokwim 300, and among those cheering Kaiser at the finish were his parents, who also live in Bethel. He hugged his girlfriend Bethany, who met him with their 2-year-old son, Ari. Defending champion Roan Boozer led nearly the entire race until Kaiser passed him around Akiak. Kaiser had been steadily gaining on Boozer for the latter 2/3 of the race. Any hope that Boozer may have had to regain the lead was lost when he took a wrong turn into Church Slough about 12 miles from the finish. At the time of the finish, it was unclear what the consequences would be for diverting from the main race trail. Roan Boozer spoke with fans at the finish.
I missed the one you can't miss, apparently.
His father, Martin Boozer, made the same wrong turn. After a conservative start, Kaiser and Jeff King systematically chipped away at Boozer's lead.
This team is so locked into a speed right now that they just, whether they're fresh or tired, they pretty much get into that speed and that's where they stay.
The last local musher to win the K300 title was Bethel's Myron Angstman in 1986.
It's a real community event and taken a long time for that to come around, and it's cool it's finally happened.
Jeff King arrived at 5:58 a.m. in third place. Tony Browning was fourth at 6:31 and Ken Anderson fifth at 6:35. This year's purse was the richest ever, totaling over $123,000. Kaiser earns $25,000 for his first place performance. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015, at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. There will be opportunities for the public to testify on both agenda and non-agenda items. Any public comments that relate to specific fisheries proposals will be allowed. Information at 800-478-1456 or at subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.